When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, my name's David Runciman, and this is Past, Present, Future. Welcome to the first episode in our brand new series about the history of bad ideas. We're going to be talking to a range of different people about some of the really bad ideas that have taken a hold of people who are not necessarily bad. Today, I'm talking to the geneticist and science writer and science communicator Adam Rutherford about eugenics, a bad idea, but one that has had, and in some ways continues to have, a remarkable influence on a lot of different people. Adam, maybe we should start by just trying to define what eugenics is, but also what makes it different, because you know, I think a lot of people will be aware, in many human societies across the ages, in various brutal and appalling ways, that there has been a practice going back to the ancient world to try and weed out weakness, to select people for certain kinds of strength, particularly military strength, ancient Sparta, disabled children, babies born and thought not to be fit for civic life were left out to die. Healthy young people were encouraged to get together and have kids. But eugenics is something else. Is the thing that makes it different the so-called scientific underpinning of it? This is a essentially late 19th century idea. Is that what makes it different from a more widespread and unpleasant human practice, which is thinking that you should encourage the stronger to breed together?
Well, I'm not sure it is different from what had preceded it as an idea, as you describe, the attempts to control reproduction in order to nurture a healthier society or better quality people, as it was often framed. I think that what happens in the late 19th century is in the years after The Origin of Species and evolution by natural selection being formalized by Darwin, you get what is what I call the scientification of an old idea. And this is that sort of turning point, I think, has been crucial to all my work, which is that how new scientific ideas become co-opted or marshaled into pre-existing ideologies. So it gets a new name in 1883, but I think that eugenics inherently is a way of thinking more than anything else. And it predates the word and it predates the 19th century, as far as we can tell, throughout cultures around the world. In pretty much all cultures, there have been versions of what we now call eugenics through, as you say, selective breeding. So Plato describes the it never comes to pass, but the utopian idea of having particular categories of men and women should be mated, should be encouraged to procreate at marriage festivals, annual marriage festivals. He talks about that in Republic. That never comes to pass. There's Plutarch talks about the Spartans doing exactly the same thing. We don't really know whether that happened or not, but because there's very few sources on it. But this sort of militaristic selection process to purge the weak from society becomes a sort of mainstay of that type of eugenic style thinking. We think that it happened in Rome. Seneca describes the purging of the weak and the drowning of babies who are deformed. So there are dozens of examples of infanticide and deliberate designed marriage partnerships in order to nurture a better quality, I'm using air quotes for that, of society. So and there's another thing which we need to sort of talk about up front, which is that there's a semantic argument about eugenics which continues to this day. And I think a lot of they're quite dull arguments because ultimately they're about whether the word eugenics means something specific or not. And to a certain degree, I slightly don't care. You get a lot of people who are you know, controversialists or sort of philosophical posers who come in and say, well, we don't mate randomly, right? We choose who we have children with. We choose people who tend to be in the same socioeconomic demographic, who have similar levels of cognitive abilities, social class, and blah, blah, blah. We want our children to be free of suffering. Are these eugenics practices? Well, you know, if your definition of eugenics is so broad that it includes actually choosing to get married and choosing partners to have sex with, then sure, whatever, I don't care. I think that the formalization of eugenics in the 19th century and the definition I sort of try to latch onto is that this is a top-down, state-imposed sanctioning of reproductive rights, which, as we've been talking about, has existed as a mode of thinking throughout human culture and continues to exist to this day. But it becomes formalized in the 19th century. And then it is the development of those ideas in various countries around the world, which is the sort of eugenics that I focus on.
One of the things we're interested in this series is why certain bad ideas take hold at particular times and get adopted by people who aren't obviously bad. Some of the people who adopted eugenics were very bad, and we might come on to some of those. But what's extraordinary about it at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century is the relative ubiquity of the idea that eugenics projects, eugenics societies, you know, people were encouraged to join, you know, talking groups, which was to sort of talk about ways in which this could be put into practice. And presumably two things were going on here, one of which is what you call the scientification of something that's already existed, both genetic understanding such as it was back then and also the impact of Darwinism. And then the other thing is, what were people afraid of? That's one of the questions you always have to ask. What is the thing that this was tapping into? What was it channeling? If we just do the scientification first, the late 19th century, what was it that the people who were pushing this found in Darwin and also in their understanding of how heredity worked? So my understanding is that Galton, for instance, he read Darwin, Origin of the Species, and he was particularly taken by the chapter on animal breeding. So he thought there's something about what, again, is a very, very common practice, didn't require modern science for people to understand some of the basics of animal breeding. But something about Darwin's account persuaded him that this could be applied in a scientific or pseudoscientific way to human beings. So what was it that someone like Galton saw in Darwin that made him think, ha, we can do this now in a way that has scientific underpinning?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We mustn't forget that Galton was Darwin's half-cousin, so they shared one grandfather. And he was deeply enamored with Darwin and the notion that there was genius in their family. Of course, you know, Charles Darwin was not the first great Darwin, and the Galtons were a very successful branch of that family as well, and they married into the Wedgwoods and the Keyneses, and, you know,
It was a smaller world back then, but still.
Indeed it was. And in fact, of course, Charles married his first cousin, but that's for another conversation. So Galton is interested in the selection of particular qualities within families, and that becomes his first book, Hereditary Genius, in which he deals with mostly intellectual pursuits and the heredity of specific intellectual characteristics in families. So animal breeding is used as an analogy throughout the pre-Darwinian era, through, you know, pre-eugenics, as a model. We can change and we deliberately select animals for particular characteristics. And then, yeah, as you quite rightly point out, the first chapter of The Origin of Species is not about natural selection at all. It's about artificial selection through breeding. There's a lot about, you know, pigeons. And what Darwin is doing in that first chapter is demonstrating the mutability of organisms in particular methods for breeding, which sets up the idea of the sort of partner to artificial selection, which is that this happens in nature, natural selection. So the connection with farming and breeding predates Galton, but then is used as the sort of overarching analogy with what we should be doing with humans. If humans are animals and can change over generational time through selection, as we have done with sheep and cows and plants for the last 10,000 years, then why shouldn't we be doing the same with humans in order to create a better stock, is the word that Darwin used, a better stock of the British people? There are many reasons why it's a fallacious argument, and perhaps we'll get into those later, because they tend to be, they're quite scientifically and agriculturally interesting. But then the second part of the question was about what do people fear? Well, again, this kind of relates to why, sort of almost again, a semantic argument about what eugenics actually is. What you see is the latching onto this new or sort of very authoritarian view of how society should be crafted. I describe it in one of my books as being it's radical, but in order to maintain the status quo. So it's simultaneously radical and conservative, which I think is an interesting phenomenon in itself. But you've got a, well, I don't know, was the Victorian era more tumultuous than others? I think all eras tend to be quite tumultuous. Maybe in 100 years, we'll look back at, you know, the first two decades of the 21st century and think, God, that was a crazy time. But you've got the Industrial Revolution ongoing. You've got British Empire reaching its peak at the beginning of the Edwardian period. You've got mass immigration, urbanization, a much more visible poor. You've got the repeal of the Tudor poor laws. So the state is taking a much more active role in the protection of the most deprived members of society. So there's a lot of change happening in Victorian Britain. In the 1890s, you've got the Boer War, where the British get their asses handed to them by what are deemed an inferior race. So scientific racism is pretty much universally held that white people are superior to other categories of people from around the world. So there's lots of public fretting about why various societal ills, including difficulties in empire, are occurring. And I think societies often turn to the authorities of science or the perceived authority of science at times like this to say, well, fix this. You can fix this. You've come up with a new theory and it's very appealing because it says that there's a much more significant biological component to social ills. And therefore, we have a sort of, you know, tenable thing that we can latch onto. It's biology rather than society that is causing these problems, or at least we're looking to biology or looking to science as a potential solution to it. And I think that's one of the reasons why eugenics takes off and becomes, as you say, not universally, but very, very popular across social and political spectra. Well, one of the things I think is interesting is you get the overarching idea is very similar all around the world where eugenics is either explored or enacted, but you get regional differences. And I expect we'll come on to, my work focuses on the West. So the emergence of the idea in the UK, its transfer to America and the transfer from America to Nazi Germany is where my focus is. And what you see is similar but different implementation in the UK, very much about class, in America, very much about immigration, and in Germany, it's very medicalized. I'm broadly generalizing, but you see these regional distinctions, which are born of what those societies and those cultures are most concerned with at those times.
And one of the things I think is true even in the early 20th century is that people had started to notice something that they continue to notice to this day, which is with certain social trends, for instance, the education of women, with certain groups being given social or other advantages and privileges, they have an understandable tendency when they can to have fewer children. And so the fear that underpins it, and one of the things that unquestionably, I think, drove eugenics at the beginning of the 20th century, was the belief that absent eugenics, a force was at work in the world that would be disastrous for intellectual, political, cultural elites, because while they're doing their stuff, they're not having kids, and either the poor or non-whites or immigrants or whoever it is are going to outbreed them. And that almost global picture, which I think does make it a bit different from Spartan eugenics, whatever it is, which is that sense that there are these social trends at work in the world, which we can now see it's self-defeating for certain kinds of progress to be allowed to happen without this to back it up, because what you will get is people progressing out of reproduction, leaving reproduction to the people that we don't want to reproduce. And I think that does cut across these different places. So what is the fear? Is it about race in some places? Is it about class in other places? Is it about physical inadequacy? But it's the fear is being outbred, isn't it?
Yes. And I think it is all of those things and those regional differences, but I think it's always about power. So eugenics isn't the ultimate expression of hegemonic power. It is. And that's why that's the both. We have to do something radical in order to maintain the status quo. It is developed by, and I don't mean to be crude about this, but it's developed by wealthy white Western European elites. And those are the people that latch onto this because they see these threats. Now, there's a specific channel on this, which I think is interesting, which is that within the eugenics movements, particularly in the UK, also in Germany, less so in America, but there is a particular fetishization of ancient Greece and Rome, and to a lesser extent, ancient Egypt. And I've speculated in the past as to why this might be. I mean, these are my speculations and therefore discussion and writing papers about on which I may well be wrong. But I think a big part of it in the UK is the intellectual and political elites who all go to, you know, four schools.
And two universities.
And two universities.
Or one.
One of which they're very disparaging about. the one that you might be sitting at right now. Because Cambridge actually gets off quite lightly with eugenics, but Oxford doesn't. And of course, I'm at UCL, which is the heartland of this idea, but we'll come back to that. But there's a great veneration of the classics. Almost all of the key players go to Eton, Harrow, Winchester, one of the public schools, and then go off to Oxbridge, where they read maths and classics, or history and classics. I think that many of the specific people that I've focused on in my work, who tend to be more scientific than political, because I am a working scientist, they have a very unsophisticated understanding, or they appear to display a very unsophisticated understanding of the classics whilst being very much intellectually reverent towards them. I think they read the title page of Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, of Gibbon, and didn't go much further than that. So the notion that Rome fell as a result of exactly the things that you said in your question, the decadent upper classes...
They stop having kids,
and the enemies are at the gates, and Rome topples because a load of immigrants are having tons of kids, and we forgot to reproduce while we were being so clever and debauched. And that seems to be a permanent phantom menace that all the way through, and it persists to this day. It's sort of formalized as great replacement theory in the 1920s, and that is part of the public discourse today. That is very much, I argue, that this is the way of thinking of eugenics that is sort of, once eugenics became a toxic idea, the idea did not go away, just the word became toxic. So that threat continues. Western civilization, whatever that is, seems to be have been under constant threat since about the 4th century as a result of exactly this phenomenon that we in power are not having enough children, and other people who are not part of our intellectual and cultural heritage are having far too many. It doesn't feel like a robust argument to me, because white Western cultural civilization has been the dominant one in the white West for the last, I don't know, couple of thousand years. It seems to be doing fine, as far as I can tell.
Did the scientific underpinning at the end of the 19th century allow them, therefore, to make this argument in terms that didn't look like they were self-interested or about power or propping up existing structures of power? You could dress it up in the language of Darwinism or something else as a universal theory. This is just, you know, this is the truth, right? This is the way of the world. But what did they then get wrong? So it's scientification. There is science behind it in the sense that these people were scientists and they had some understanding. But they seem to have fundamentally misunderstood at least some of the ways in which you could extrapolate, for instance, what Darwin might say about animal breeding to human societies. What is the thing you think they fundamentally got wrong? And was it willful misunderstanding, or was it they just missed it?
I think there are different elements to the bits of the science which don't add up. And I think it's a really interesting example of how, in this process in the 19th century, where science becomes much more formalized and we develop many of the models of how scientific information is disseminated today, like journals and peer review kind of comes later, but it becomes formalized from the sort of gentleman scientists of, you know, idling away collecting beetles in the 19th century and before, and becomes a formal intellectual pursuit. One of the things that scientists like to believe, which I think is a lie, is that it is science is a methodology which is above the grubby worlds of politics and opinions and philosophers and the humanities, because we work to a higher standard where our methodology has evolved and has been designed to remove the intellectual and cultural baggages that we all have, right? It's a complete fiction, of course. And I often get into arguments with particularly physicists and engineers who really, really, truly believe this. But science occurs within society and it carries with it the cultural baggages of the people performing it. So if you've got a bunch of people who are political and cultural elites deciding that this is a branch of science which is new and therefore interesting, but also above the threshold of intellectual or personal psychological biases, what they do is they just reinforce them completely. The perfect example is at the birth of eugenics with Galton himself, who attempts in his first, it's before eugenics, but before he comes up with the word eugenics, but in his book, Hereditary Genius, he attempts to apply statistical norms and calculations to the process by which the real observation, which is that people within the same families tend to succeed at elite levels at the same professions. So he looks at classical composers and conductors and politicians and lawyers and sees that there's these patterns of great men. He's really not interested in women at all, but these patterns of great men run through these families. And he tries to apply new statistical techniques, many of which he has developed himself, in order to show that these things are immutable, heritable characteristics, which are therefore biology and not society. And the kind of the funny thing about them is that he just cannot see his own inherent biases, his own cultural biases within them. How he deems men are geniuses is based on his opinion, the opinions of others, and obituaries. So his data is literally opinion. And he seems so stunningly blinded by these cultural norms that I find it quite amusing. It's much less amusing when you see the emergence of the same sort of willing blindness in the 20th century, which you continue to see as the ideas develop. And also today, I do a series of lectures at UCL in which I say that all science is political and all data is bias. And they're slight provocations, but they're provocations because I want scientists to stop thinking that what they do is somehow just this pure empirical data is neutral. It's what you dirty philosophers and politicians and humanities people do with the data that we generate, which is where things go wrong. It's not like that. All science is political, always has been and always will be.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
This was also the era where people were applying Darwin in lots of different ways, in different contexts, and either willfully or inadvertently misrepresenting what Darwinian evolution meant and what it stood for, and particularly sort of erasing the randomness from it, trying to overdetermine it. Spencer and the survival of the fittest, or genuine misunderstandings like Lamarckian versions of heredity, the idea that inherited characteristics can come from what you do in your own lifetime. If you're hardworking, you can pass on that to your kids and so on. So how much of this is informed by that? There are lots of different ways in which people take the Darwinian account of evolution, which doesn't really in itself, I think, provide much fuel for this because it's over such a long period. These are random mutations. So this is not something that is engineered. It's the randomness. It is the fact that the genetic, as we now know, the genetic mutations are what drive this. And at that period, people wanted to impose on that something much more structured, something much less random, more controllable, but in so doing, got it wrong, unless I've misunderstood it. I mean, they tried to make the scientific story of evolution into something more humanly malleable, and it's just not. I mean, the timeframes are wrong for a start, aren't they?
Well, that's definitely true, and I think that is one of the fundamental problems in the sort of public understanding and the transfer of evolutionary theory to non-evolutionary biologists. That's a slightly different issue. I think timescales in science are always problematic because people operate at different times. You know, physicists either think in nanoseconds or billions of years, and people like me think in tens of thousands of years, whereas normal people think in one to two generations. But that, I think that's a slight side issue. There's a sort of chunk of the history of science which is semi-important here, which is that evolution by natural selection is first outlined in 1858, in fact, a year before the Origin of Species. And I do think it has a revolutionary moment. I'm, in general, I'm opposed to sort of intellectual, the concept of post-hoc intellectual revolutions, but things were different before and after. But it's a long time before that idea becomes either understood well or formalized with a mechanism. And for the next 30 years, really up until the beginning of the 20th century, the mechanism by which natural selection actually occurs is not understood. And Darwin was very Lamarckian until he died. It really comes in the 1890s. Francis Galton is part of this work, as is August Weismann, a German evolutionary biologist.
And it should be said, Galton was not Lamarckian.
Yes, that is right. But they really didn't know what was being transferred from generation to generation. And so Darwin had already proposed there was a specific mechanism, gemmules in plants, by which they could acquire the characteristics and they would be passed on. That isn't what happens. It is the formulation that this concept of, well, genes doesn't become described, the concept of units of inheritance, which become known as genes, doesn't happen until 1900, 1901. But it is the recognition, primarily by Galton and Weismann, that evolution occurs in individuals, in populations, right? So it is the transfer, it is the frequency of particular versions of units of inheritance, we now call genes, that allows evolution to happen. And this leads on to what I think is the most important bit in the politicization of the science of evolutionary thought and genetics, because it is Mendel and the rediscovery of Mendel's work, where he effectively has identified the concept of the gene. You know, we all learn this at high school when he's measuring his pea plants in the 1860s, but that work is written in German and isn't very cited until it gets translated into English in 1900. And all of a sudden, you've got the actual mechanism by which natural selection can occur. So that's the great fusion of these two ideas. Genetics is born, evolution by natural selection is 40 years old. And over the next decade or so, mostly at UCL and Cambridge and some in the States, those two ideas are fused together. And that's where contemporary evolutionary biology comes from. But the problem is that Mendel's work was immediately latched onto by the eugenicists, who have this very hereditarian view, which is that nature, i.e. genetics, is more important than nurture. And by the way, it's Galton who comes up with the phrase nature versus nurture. But particularly the American eugenicists grab hold of Mendel and go, well, now we've got units of selection. We've now got genes. We now know the biological unit, the molecules that are being passed from parent to child in families. And therefore, we can attribute behavioral characteristics as well as physical characteristics onto these units of selection, genes. And therefore, we have a pivot on which eugenics policies can be enacted. Now, that didn't really happen in the UK, partly for nerdy reasons that the scientists involved, people like Carl Pearce and Ronald Fisher, thought that the stats being generated by the Americans, mostly at Cold Spring Harbor, led by Charles Davenport, they just didn't see that they thought their experiments were crap. And they were. But it was that bit of the scientification that occurred in the States where we go, we've got genes for eye color, we've got genes for hair color, all that sort of stuff that we learn at school. which incidentally mostly come from the eugenics labs of in the States and incidentally are not very true. But they just go, well, we've got physical characteristics which have genes, which therefore can be are subject to selection, but also behavioral ones, such as seafaringness or anxiety or depression or sexual proclivities or any characteristic which falls into the category of stuff that is either desirable or undesirable. There's a gene for it, and therefore we have this pivot on which potential selection against or for those characteristics can be enacted. And it's just not that that's not how biology works. And they just were unwilling to see that it's kind of obvious to us now, but I think it might have been more obvious. I think it could have been obvious to them then, but their political and cultural biases were such that they were unwilling to acknowledge it.
Is the basic failure of understanding on their part here that they simply drew too straight a line from the genetic basis to the behavior that they wanted to select for, you know, that seafaringness has a gene? Or is the fundamental failure here the failure to recognize that what produces change over time is mutation? So what they want to do is select for the thing that they want and then sort of perpetuate this going forward. Whereas actually, it is a much more mutable story by definition. And so what you're trying to do is strip out the thing that drives it.
Well, I think you earlier have identified one of the problems with failing to observe the mutability of genes, which is that time scale, right? So time scale just doesn't allow for us to see evolution happening over single or a few generations. So in terms of changing the structure of society, me and you could set up a plan where we definitely change the structure of society. And we will record this podcast in 1,000 years' time, and we will have seen that complete structural change. Great. We see shorter time span changes occurring. We see selection for disease resistance over shorter time spans. We see the classic example that people like me always give is the very rapid adoption of lactase persistence. So the ability to digest milk after weaning, which we see emerge sort of 6,000 or 7,000 years ago in Europe in dairy farming, and it spreads very quickly and enables us to process milk after we've been breastfed. But when people like this, when people like me say very rapidly, I'm talking about a minimum of a few centuries, but more like several thousand years. And so that timescale that you identified is really a big issue at this time. But I think that the more significant concern, and this is particularly for the American eugenicists who really latched onto this idea, seafaringness does run in families. Of course it does. You know, people, less so in the modern era, but people who sail ships, their children often sail ships as well. People at the bottom end of society, so who are prone to afflictions that are associated with poverty, name many of them, alcoholism, specific diseases. Almost all diseases affect the poor much more than they do the wealthy. Yet they run in families because the single most heritable characteristic that we can identify in human beings is money, wealth, right? So if wealth becomes wealth correlates significantly with particular characteristics which are either desirable or undesirable, then you will see these things running in families. But that idea is taught to us as geneticists. Steve Jones said that. He was my old tutor, still teaches at UCL. I was an undergraduate with him. That's week one of Introduction to Evolutionary Genetics. And it seems so obvious that I can say it to you now. But I think a lot of people don't recognize that. So as a geneticist in the modern era, I don't discount the importance of genetics at all. I'm not a blank slater. Genetics is super important. But they're important in the environmental context in which you're raised. And I think the hereditarians and the eugenicists then and to this day think that the nature side, the genetics, the inherent unchangeable aspect of human characteristics, behavior, and society is more important and dominant over the cultural. And I think that what's emerged in the 20th century is that one of the most difficult bits of biology human biology to unpick, but B, it's also just not very true. There's a little. I want to just say this very briefly because when I get into these types of arguments with more hereditarian or more racist thinkers, they often throw out the stat of heritability, but it's a heritability is a terrible word which doesn't describe what it sounds like, because it sounds like inheritance, it sounds like heritable, but that is, it's a specific and scientific term. Biologists, I often say, are very bad at naming things. They either give complex things simple names or relatively straightforward things ridiculously complicated names. Whereas, you know, physicists will say there's a mathematical conjecture out there which we've measured and modeled and we'll call it a black hole. And everyone goes, black holes are cool, right?
Or Big Bang. That's a good name.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It wasn't big and it wasn't a bang.
That's a good name, though.
But we go, it turns out that genes don't get inherited uniquely. It depends on how closely physically close they are on chromosomes to other genes. So we will call this linkage disequilibrium. You know, that doesn't help anyone whatsoever. Or they say that in a population, the difference between the maximum and the minimum variance in a particular characteristic we can observe and measure how much of that is genetic and how much of that is environmental, and we'll call it heritability. Right. And so in my experience, 90% of people who use that heritability as an argument for why things are more biologically determined than culturally, they don't actually know what heritable means.
I actually want to bypass the Nazis here, because as I said at the beginning, one of the things we're interested in is, you know, these ideas take hold not just among bad people, but particularly in the first couple of decades of the 20th century among very respectable people. As you said, you know, Galton is the villain of this story, and he's also the hero in some ways of some aspects of this story. But I'm particularly interested in then the versions of it now that you touched on at the beginning. You said that eugenics, as you want to use the term, is this top-down sort of society-wide project in which elites try to construct a version of a society that suits their interests, that's simultaneously radical and conservative. And you can see a bit of that in the world that we live in now, but I think not on the scale that you saw it 100 years ago. What you do see a lot of in the world that we live now is something more bottom-up. So you might not want to call it eugenics, but, you know, it's capable of having society-wide implications. So I think the obvious instance of this is selective abortion for sex in many parts of the world. You know, once ultrasound made it possible, and particularly in China under the one-child policy, but by no means just in China, where there is a strong social preference for a boy rather than a girl. And when you can identify that early enough, you can get highly selective abortion that produces an enormous surplus of boys. Now, I don't think any elite would want to design a society like that unless they were thinking of engaging in a war where you need tens of millions of boys, men, young men to serve as soldiers. It produces huge imbalances. It's a real problem in China. It's a real problem in India. There are too many young men and not enough young women. Is it wrong to sort of fold that into the broader category of what we've just been talking about, to call it a form of eugenics? I'm not sure what the answer to that is. I'm genuinely curious. Do you want to put that to one side, or do you want to see this as part of a single story of how human beings can use knowledge and understanding to create these undesirable, to put it mildly, social consequences?
I think it's a very valid question to ask, and I think it is important to ask this question. Referring back to the first answer, I don't much care for it being a semantic argument about whether this is or isn't eugenics, because I don't think it helps us to try and understand or pass the significance of the ideas being actually debated. So there's two different things there that you mentioned. So the first is reproductive technologies, which were mostly invented by human genetics labs in the second half of the 20th century, including my own, many of which were eugenics laboratories until they slowly, after 1945, decided that eugenics was maybe not the right word. There was a lot of rebranding. The Annals of Eugenics, which came effectively out of UCL, out of the lab that I'm in, just renamed itself the Annals of Human Genetics in 1954 with no announcement, no, there's no editorial which says we're doing this. It just, the name changed. I have the two bound volumes on my shelf in my office next to each other. And the transition between the two of them is seamless, apart from being quite jarring. And that happened all around the world. Eugenics labs became genetics labs. There was a fundamental difference slowly that emerged, which was that the technologies developed, often with the more scientific end of eugenics as their foundations, were very much for the alleviation of suffering in individuals, in children and their parents by extension, and to give choice about the suffering of their children or reducing the suffering of their potential children. So things like IVF or genetic counseling, and then into the 80s, we have things like pre-implantation diagnosis associated with the IVF process, where you can choose the embryos that get re-implanted and you can choose for them to be free of specific diseases. Now, are they eugenics? I don't think they are. I think they would have been of great interest to the eugenicists of the 1920s and 30s, but I don't think it's useful to label them as such, as often happens in the popular discourse. But then what emerges from our increased, the amazing advances in technology is that you do get to situations like selective abortions, where it begins to look much more like the eugenics of the 1920s and 30s. One of the most difficult and I think unique cases is with Down syndrome. Because it has a particular genetic characteristic, which is having an extra, a whole extra chromosome, and because it's diagnosable at a very early stage of pregnancy, in countries in the last few years where access to abortions is widespread or universal, what we have seen, Denmark and Iceland being the prime examples, is the selective abortion of embryos with Downs reaching effectively 100%. In the UK, I think, I can't remember exactly what it is, but I think it's above 90% of women whose pregnancy is determined to be trisomy 21 choose to abort. One country where the opposite is happening, interestingly, is America. But that's less to do with choice. It's more to do with the reduction of choice because abortions are becoming much more difficult to get hold of and after Roe v. Wade. Now, is that eugenics? So we've offered the people the chance to select against a type of human being that otherwise does exist in the world. And it seems that in many countries where that choice is given, that the decision made by individuals that this type of person will not continue to exist in the future has been taken. I find this one of the most difficult bioethical issues that we face. There are many campaigners for people with Downs who say this is eugenics and reject, campaign against that ability. I think that often this is a complexity which requires great nuance and great care in discussing. Downs is a characteristic which has huge variance. So there are some people with Downs who are very high functioning and live semi-independent lives. And there are some people born with Downs who live extremely troubled lives. And in a sense, the etiology, the genetic etiology is the same in both, but we don't really understand why there is such variance in the penetrance and the severity of having Downs. But again, I ask my students to consider these ideas very carefully because, by extension, we as a society need to really, really carefully think about how the technology that we are developing, that we have developed in order to alleviate suffering in individuals, can manifest in doing exactly the same things that we did 100 years ago. So, for example, a non-trivial example, but achondroplasia, so classical dwarfism caused by a specific mutation in a specific gene, 100 years ago in Nazi Germany, you would be killed. Not 100 years ago in Nazi Germany. That would be Weimar Germany. But in that era, you would be subject to extermination. 100 years later, we regard achondroplasia as characteristic of human beings that are part of society and part of the rich fabric of society. Other diseases that were categorized as subject to eugenic selection, negative eugenic selection, particularly in Germany, such as Huntington's disease or schizophrenia. Again, now we are much less judgmental about these people continuing to exist in the future. And then by extension, there were one of the big problems with eugenics is by intending to improve the quality of a people, again, air quotes for quality, you have to decide who are the people who are worth preserving. And because it's a expression of hegemonic power, they tend to be the people who are most like the people that are forming those laws. And rapidly, every time we see eugenics explored or enacted, it goes immigrant classes or racialized minorities. These are the people being negatively selected. It becomes epileptics, alcoholics. It becomes women with menstrual troubles, very broad psychiatric disorders like, you know, the what used to be called feeble-mindedness, very difficult to classify that. And people with achondroplasia, people with Down syndrome. I think that one of the marks of the interesting progress that in Western Europe and by extension America we've made in the last 100 years is the differential acceptance of categories which were previously deemed to be undesirable. But again, you know, this is why we need to look carefully at the history, because there's all sorts of people who wouldn't have been allowed to exist in the past who do exist today and that have just become part of the fabrics of society.
Last question. So as you say, part of the shift here is to the language of the relief of suffering of a potential unborn human who might live a miserable life. It's also about the relief of suffering of the parents, clearly. I mean, that's part of it. It's, after all, the parents who are making the choice, and they're the ones that are also judging what they can live with. In a case like the one that I mentioned that we touched on there, which is, you know, the one that's had the largest scale effects, which is selection for sex, that's not about the relief of suffering of the child. In fact, actually, if you're going to produce 100 million surplus boys, those boys are going to suffer more than the girls would do, because they, you know, many of them are not going to be able to have stable family lives and so on. And the unit that's being considered there that might suffer is the family rather than the individual. You know, it's better for a family in a society, particularly when it's sanctioned that only one child can be born, for the child to be a boy. So it's very hard, that there's a, you know, a difficulty of knowing where to draw the line in the language of suffering. But there's also the question of, you know, what you might call positive eugenics at the micro level, people selecting for things that they think will be a positive or net benefit, say for the family unit, a male child. And now we are, after all, in the age of the possibility of quite fine-tuned selection for things that might make things go better for the parents, or might, you know, you feel the family would be better off if the child not just was relieved of suffering, but had certain characteristics. When you look at this going forward, there are lots of potential dangers here, including a throwback to an earlier era of top-down state-sanctioned interference. And after all, that story I just described does partly in China come out of a one-child policy, which was itself a disastrous misunderstanding of what the future was going to be like. But where do you see the real threat here? Is the greatest danger actually that the slippage from choice for relief of suffering to something more like convenience, or at least it's kind of, there's a consumerist version of this, right? There is, you know, there is a nightmare version, which is what you might call consumerist eugenics. And actually, I think choosing to have a boy rather than girl is a version of that. I mean, I'm not trying to be unsympathetic to the people who make that choice. You only have one life, and if you can only have one child, but it's, you know, it's on that spectrum, right? Which could go right the way through to picking for someone who's going to do well in life, and that's going to be better for the family.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is a version of that which is already occurring in certain countries, the biggest and most significant one being America, where with embryo selection for various diseases, which is what we've had in the West since 1980 during the IVF process, in Europe and most of the world, we are prevented legally from selecting embryos for traits rather than diseases. But in America, that is not the case. And there are already companies in, and we think there are children already born who have been specifically selected for traits rather than for the prevention of specific diseases that might run in the family.
What kind of traits are we talking about?
Well, so the only one that people are really interested in is this very fuzzy concept of intelligence, which is a highly heritable, you know, however we define it, and it's a very difficult thing to define. People over rely on metrics like IQ, which I'm not an IQ denialist. I think it has some value, but you know, you've got to really scrutinize what you understand by IQ and what its value is, which is for a different discussion. However you measure cognitive abilities, which, so IQ correlates very well with things like educational attainment, so how long you stay in further education and so on. But however you assess it, there's good work which suggests that we are beginning to understand the genetic architecture which is associated with those traits at a population level. Now, a third year undergraduate at UCL or Cambridge or Oxford might be asked by someone like me to write a dissertation on the complexities of the two sentences I just said, because they are enormously complicated issues. But the way it gets translated into the public discourse, and as you're talking about now, a version of consumer genetics or consumer eugenics, is hugely simplified to the point of being, set aside the moral or the ethical problems with inherent in this sort of selection process, but also scientifically idiotic, scientifically ridiculous. So I think with several of the companies that are offering this kind of embryo selection for genes associated with intelligence, I think the parents are dropping hundreds of grand on stuff where, if you actually measure what we know about genetics and how it relates to intelligence, they're effectively choosing maybe an IQ point or two, the type of thing that you can change by having a decent night's sleep or a cup of coffee before taking an IQ test. And also the association with the increased probability of characteristics like high IQ with things like eating disorders or anorexia or depression, which also correlate with high intelligence or various things like that. The complexities of the genomes are really only just beginning to be understood. But that's where the analogy with what we do today, now that we're in the genomic era, tallies with the 1910s, with the over-reliance on the new science of Mendelian inheritance, what the eugenicists were thinking of back then. I don't know a geneticist who would make these decisions in terms of embryo selection. We don't know how the genetics of eye color works, right? In 1907, Charles Davenport, the founder of American eugenics, published the first paper which described the inheritance pattern of blue eyes. And we've been teaching that ever since, to the extent that it's still in the GCSE curriculum and equivalent curricula all around the world. Now, it's basically wrong, right? There are recessive genes and there are dominant genes, but you don't need to have two versions of one gene to have blue eyes. You don't need to have two blue-eyed parents to have blue, you know, blah, blah. Basically, any color combination of parents' eyes can produce any color combination of children's eyes. But we teach this version, which was both deterministic and monogenic, and was part of the eugenics sort of ideology of those people at the time. Now, we're so wedded culturally to this sort of monogenic deterministic version of inheritance, when actually, you know, here I am, as someone who's been studying this for 30 years, telling you that I don't know how the genetics of eye color works. My PhD was on the development of the human eye, and I don't know it. I'm not saying I don't know it, but other people do. I'm saying that we don't know it.
You're saying, if I don't know it, nobody knows it.
Well, that sounds a little bit arrogant, but basically, yes. Yeah. So my issue is, if we don't know how the genetics of blue eyes actually works, and we're talking about embryo selection for really fuzzy, complex concepts like cognitive ability compared to, you know, physical traits like eye color, you know, if you're selling this as a product, I wouldn't, you know, when you do a 23andMe test, right, you know, you spit in a tube and it comes back with some ancestry information, which I also think is fundamentally flawed at best. On the version I've got, it says that with your version of this particular gene, there's a 66% chance that you have brown eyes. Now, that is actually good genetics education, because it means that 66% of people who have the same version of that one gene, which is associated with blue or brown eyes, 66% of those people who have the same version as me have brown eyes. You dig me up in 1,000 years' time and get my genome out and look at that particular gene, you've got a two in three chance of getting my eye color right. So if we do that for embryo selection, would you take those odds? I don't know. I wouldn't. I'm not really a betting kind of guy. But that's eye color. So if you look at the genes involved in intelligence, of which there are hundreds, thousands, maybe half the genome has some role in the brain, and said, do you want to flip a coin and say, you know, this embryo might be a bit smarter than this one? I'm like, you know, no. This is astrology you're talking about. This isn't science. But you're paying hundreds of grand just to get your kid that far advanced. We know what the correlates of intelligence are. Right? It's whether you read to your kids or not. It's education. It's universal access to healthcare. But those things are socially determined and we know how to fix them. But it's much easier to turn to science and go, can you fix this? Because you guys look really clever.
And we do have to end here. But I would also say that if you were really concerned about relieving the suffering of children, the one thing you would want to guard against is having to have a child listen to a parent say, I spent 200 grand on you. Work harder. Your grades aren't good enough. I mean, and I'm not even joking, actually. That is one nightmarish version of this.
In some of those consumer genetic tests that are available, so I a lot of my work focuses on sport. I'm writing a book about genetics and sport right now. And you can buy, not in the UK because it's legislated against, but in America, you can buy tests where you get your child to spit in the tube, send it off, and the report that comes back says your son or daughter should play baseball and not tennis, or American football and not hockey because of their genetics. Now, if you're that interested, I just feel bad for those kids and those families because you've ruined their lives before they've even picked up a baseball bat.
I mean, you've ruined their lives anyway when parents want to make their kids professional athletes. But when they also say, and there's, look, this thing, you should be doing better at baseball, that is the dystopian version.
Mate, I'm not going near that.
If you'd like to find out more about this series, do follow us on Twitter at PPF Ideas, and you can sign up now to PPF Plus, where you can get ad-free listening and also the bonus episodes that go with this and all our series. Just go to ppfideas.com or click on the link that comes with the show description for this episode. PPF Plus listeners can now get the first of our bonus episodes with Leah Rippey to accompany our series on the history of freedom, in which Leah and I talk about, among many other things, whether we are living in a computer simulation. We will be putting out bonus episodes to accompany this series too, including one in which I'll be talking about my bad idea. Coming up next on the History of Bad Ideas, I'm talking to the podcaster and political economist Helen Thompson about the gold standard. Is it really a bad idea? And what is the harm that it does? Do join us for that. This has been Past, Present, Future, brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.